got a sprain or an itch. Pain that's swelling or twitch, call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky, I call up and ask me. Dr. Lasky.
Welcome to another edition of Hey Doc. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, Medical Director and Physician at Southside Medical Center, right here in Jacksonville, Florida. I'm your host for the next half hour. With me today is my co-host and wife, Carmen Lasky, a certified EMT. Together, we hope that you will find the show informative, educational, as well as entertaining. For you younger listeners who may not be familiar with what you just heard, most of us over 50 certainly do remember the TV court drama that started with that theme music. It was the Perry Mason Show. During the multiple seasons that it ran, Lawyer Mason only lost 3 cases during his 271 episodes and was absent from only 6 episodes. One of these featured a different lawyer, Constance Doyle, played by the famous actress Betty Davis. I bring this up since the case was to some degree solved when Attorney Doyle noted that a shirt or jacket, I can't remember which, was buttoned in the opposite manner that a man would, meaning the apparel was a female's. I bring this up because I came across an old book that I had read years ago by Martin Gardner called The Ambidextrous Universe.
The book begins with the subject of mirror reflection, and from there passes through symmetry in the universe. It even talks about symmetry on the molecular level.
Then the book talks about the Ozma problem, which poses a problem that Gardner claims would arise if Earth should ever enter into communication with life on another planet through Project Ozma.
This is the problem of how to communicate the meaning of left and right, where the two communicants are conditionally not allowed to view any one object in common.
Humans don't typically agree on all that much, but there is at least one thing that an impressive amount of us accept: which hand is easiest to control. If you're using one hand for writing, you probably use the same one for eating as well.
As a matter of fact, about 85% of us are right-handed. In fact, there has never been any report of a human population in which left-handed individuals predominate.
You've probably heard that some tasks are largely controlled by brain activity in the left hemisphere, while the right hemisphere governs other tasks. What you may not know is that there is some crossing of nerves between the body and the brain.
It is actually the left side of the brain that has more control over the right side of the body, and vice versa. In other words, the brain's left hemisphere helps control the operation of the right hand, eye, leg, and so on.
Some say that this division of neurological labor has been a feature of animals for 500 million years. But the question remains, why are so many humans right-handed?
Apparently, when apes stand on all fours, they display no real hand preferences. But when forced to assume an upright stance, the apes did show a preference.
However, they were equally likely to be left-handed as right-handed. So what pushed early humans from a lateral preference in general to the extremely high levels of right-handedness?
When tools were first made by our early cavemen ancestors, they made their own versions of ancient stone tools using either their left or right hands to chip.
But stone tools that were made some 1.5 million years ago by two ancient human species, Homo habilis and Homo erectus, do show some evidence of species-wide right-handedness. And around 600,000 years ago, there was a clear right-handed preference in prehistoric societies.
How do the researchers know this? there are a number of things that researchers noted. For example, the preserved teeth of Homo heidelbergensis, for instance, suggests that food was usually brought to the mouth with the right hand.
So now we know when right-handed preference began, but we don't know why. Some have argued that it all comes down to language.
Remember what we said before, that generally traits controlled by one side of the brain control the other side of the body. Well, the bulk of their linguistic processing is in their brain's left hemisphere.
So maybe as language evolved in man, so did right-handedness. But there are other theories. One could be a physical one. So picture two people coming into battle opposite each other. Each holds a sword in one hand and a shield in the other. You know, like the warriors in the gladiator movies.
If you have both warriors raise their right arms, you will note that they are opposite each other.
Where is the most lethal sword shot? Well, probably one to the heart, which happens to lie on the left side of our bodies. A left-hander would have to come across the enemy's body to get that kill shot, whereas a right-hander holding his shield in the left hand not only has a shorter route to the enemy's heart, but also a quicker protection from the shield he holds covering the left side of his body.
Aha! So maybe in wars, left-handed swordsmen were more easily killed, leaving more right-handers alive.
But scientists recently ran a new study which suggests that lefties are rare because of the balance between cooperation and competition in human evolution. The researchers used real-world competitive sports data to test and confirm the hypothesis that social behavior is related to population-level handedness. The results are now published this week in the Journal of the Royal Society Interface.
They stated that the most important factor for an efficient society is a high degree of cooperation. This resulted in a right-handed majority.
So, if societies were entirely cooperative, everyone would be same-handed. But if competition were more important, one could expect the population to be 50-50.
The new model can predict accurately the percentage of left-handers in a group. Humans, parrots, baseball players, golfers, based on the degrees of cooperation and competition in social interaction.
The model also helps to explain our right-handed world now and historically. The 90-10 right-handed to left-handed ratio has remained the same for over 5,000 years. It also helps explain the dominance of left-handed athletes in many sports, where competition can drive the number of lefties up to a disproportionate level.
Cooperation favors same-handedness for sharing the same tools. For example, physical competition, on the other hand, favors the unusual. In a fight, a left-hander would have the advantage in a right-handed world.
Their model accurately predicted the number of elite left-handed athletes in baseball, boxing, hockey, fencing, and table tennis. More than 50% among top baseball players and well above 10% the general population rate for the other sports. On the other hand, the number of successful left-handed PGA golfers is very low, only 4%. The model also accurately predicted this.
So, handedness, the preference for using one hand over the other, is partially genetic and partially environmental.
If you've been listening to our previous shows, as certified medical marijuana providers here in Jacksonville, Florida, we try to bring you the latest in medical marijuana news here in the state of Florida. Remember, Florida only allows certified physicians to recommend medical marijuana to qualified patients. There's no legal recreational use of marijuana in Florida. What this means is that patients who have certain medical problems, whose diagnoses are included in the list of approved diagnoses in Florida Statute 8A, will be able to be recommended by certified physicians. Even with these restrictions, thousands of patients have been approved for the use of marijuana.
Once you are approved for its use, the certified physician will enter your information in a state database. As a patient, you will then receive a username and password by the Department of Health here in Florida. It will then be up to you to provide proof of residency here in Florida, as well as a passport type picture to the Department of Health.
That part that Carmen just went through can be done through the Internet. However, at this point, you must send a $75 payment to the state by mail in order to get your medical marijuana identification card. This will be necessary for you to obtain in order to be able to go to a medical marijuana dispensary. Here in Jacksonville, there are presently three dispensaries. One's quite close to our medical center on Beach Boulevard.
Be aware that with the huge number of new medical marijuana patients and the limited number of people working with the Department of Health to get the ID cards processed, it had been taking some patients over 1 month to get their cards.
The new statute allows the physician to recommend medical marijuana for a 70-day period with two refills allowable. This generally gives the patient 210 days before he or she needs to see the physician again in his office. The rules and regulations are in an ongoing period of creation, so we will not know the final form until around October 3rd. However, again, you can get the recommendation for medical marijuana use right now at Southside Medical Center. Our phone number is 904-641-4411. And you can also visit our site at www.compassionatecarejacks.com.
We also have a lot more information at that site, including up-to-date news about Florida's medical marijuana laws, as well as dispensary locations in and around Jacksonville.
Well, it's time for our mid-show break. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky with Carmen Lasky, and this is Hey Doc. This is a great time to tell you about Southside Medical Center. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I've been the medical director and physician at Southside Medical Center for the past 29 years. We're located at 3604 Southside Boulevard, just two blocks south of the Beach Boulevard intersection between the Pottsburg Post Office and the Tulsa Welding School. We will treat your pains, sprains, and strains. Our practice emphasizes chronic pain management as well as anti-aging medicine. We also have an office-based substance treatment program for those who need it. Southside Medical Center is open 10 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. If you would like to make an appointment or ask any questions about Southside Medical Center, please call us at 641-4411. That's 641-4411. Southside Medical Center, where your health is our primary care. Welcome back to the Hey Doc Show. I'm Dr. Harold Lasky, and I'm here with my co-host, Carmen Lasky. As we grow older, many will suffer a decline in mental and physical fitness. Now, this can be made worse by conditions like Alzheimer's disease. So what can we do about it? Well, a new study reaffirms that older people who routinely do physical exercise can reverse the signs of aging in the brain. And, listen to this, dancing has the most profound effect. I hope you heard that right, dancing.
According to Dr. Catherine Rayfield, exercise has the beneficial effects of slowing down or even counteracting age-related decline in mental and physical capacity.
You know, that's really good to know because most of the therapies that we hear about for aging just slow down the change. But here we have something that actually counteracts those declines in mental and physical capacities. Now, in that study, it showed that two different types of physical exercise, that being dancing and endurance training, both increase the area of the brain that declines with age. In comparison, though, it was only dancing that led to noticeable behavioral changes in terms of improved balance.
Elderly volunteers with an average age of 68 were recruited to the study and assign either an 18-month weekly course of learning dance routines or endurance and flexibility training.
Both groups showed an increase in the hippocampus region of the brain. Now, this is important because this area can be prone to age-related decline and is affected by diseases like Alzheimer's. It also plays a key role in memory and learning, as well as keeping one's balance.
While previous research has shown that physical exercise can combat age-related brain decline, it is not known if one type of exercise can be better than another.
To determine this, the exercise routines given to the volunteers differed. The traditional fitness training program conducted mainly repetitive exercises, such as cycling or Nordic walking, but the dance group, they were challenged with something new each and every week.
Dr. Renfeld said that they tried to provide the seniors in the dance group with the constantly changing dance routines of different genres, jazz, square, Latin, American, and line dance.
Steps, arm patterns, formations, speed, and rhythms were changed every second week to keep them in a constant learning process. The most challenging aspect for them was to recall the routines under the pressure of time and without any cues from the instructor.
These extra challenges are thought to account for the noticeable difference in balance displayed by those participants in the dancing group.
The researchers are now evaluating a new system called Jimin, Jamming and Gymnastics, which is a sensor-based system which generates sounds, melodies, rhythms, based on physical activity. It's known that dementia patients react strongly when listening to music. So the researchers combined physical activity and active music making in a feasibility study with dementia patients.
Everyone likes to live an independent and healthy life for as long as possible. Physical activity is one of the lifestyle factors that can contribute to this, counteracting several risk factors and slowing down age-related decline.
But dancing has been found to offer a powerful tool to set new challenges for body and mind, especially in older age. Another hot news item continues to be the opioid crisis. As the opioid crisis escalates, the science behind addiction still remains poorly understood. To address this need, researchers at the University of Utah Health devised a system that allows zebrafish, a small tropical fish, to self-administer doses of hydrocodone, an opioid commonly prescribed to people for pain. Now, you may know this as a component of Norco, Lortab, and Lorset, among others.
After 1 week, the fish had increased their drug-seeking behavior, even when doing so required them to put themselves in risky conditions.
Further, 48 hours after the last exposure, conditioned fish showed signs of anxiety. That's a hallmark of withdrawal. Zebrafish, if you didn't know, share 70% of their genes with people and also share similar biological pathways that lead to addiction. Like people, they have a mu opioid receptor and two neurotransmitters, dopamine and glutamate. These trigger the natural reward system in the brain. Bose and Peterson conditioned the zebrafish to the experimental setup with food. Using motion detection, the fish triggered the release of food by swimming over an active platform in the tank. An identical, inactive platform on the opposite side of the tank was the control in the study. The researchers recorded the number of times fish triggered the active platform to release food compared to the control platform.
They repeated the same setup, but instead of food, the fish conditioned to trigger the active platform received a dose of hydrocodone.
A continuous flow of water flushed the tank, which forced the fish to trigger the system to receive another dose of the drug. Over the course of 5 days, the fish self-administered the drug during 50-minute sessions. Apparently, the fish needed to perform an action to get the drug rather than just receiving it passively. Drug-seeking behavior also increased in a more stressful situation, progressively shallower water. Furthermore, fish that received a reduced dose of hydrocodone at the original depth increased their drug-seeking behavior to obtain an equivalent fix.
Conditioned zebrafish treated with naloxone, a drug that blocks the mu opioid receptor, as well as dopamine or glutamate blockers, reduced their drug-seeking behavior during the experiments.
For people, substitution therapy such as methadone, buprenorphine, and naloxone are the only available treatments for opioid addiction, and these are often leading to high rates of relapse. The researchers will use their zebrafish model system to search for new therapeutics that could block drug-seeking behavior.
Boss explained that the zebrafish model is scalable and could be used to rapidly screen through thousands of compounds. Not only that, researchers could manipulate the genetic makeup of zebrafish offspring to explore the specific biological pathways associated with drug-seeking behavior.
Our next topic pertains to bacteria in the intestine. These gut bacteria get to use a lot of our food before we do. What we finally get is their waste.
The problem, says one researcher, is that if our microbiome overindulges, we might not have access to the nutrients we need.
That's the suggestion from the new research conducted by the researchers' group that shows mice that harbor high levels of microbes that eat choline are deprived of this essential nutrient. So compared to mice without choline-hungry bacteria, the choline-starved mice had an increased susceptibility to metabolic diseases and gave birth to pups with biochemical alterations in the brain and that exhibited more anxious behaviors.
Epigenetic regulation is the decorating of genes with chemical groups that control how much they are expressed. This appears to underlie the effects of gut bacteria that consume too much choline.
Choline contributes to the pool of resources that cells use to make these modifications to DNA, and with less choline available, the cell's ability to modify and regulate genes can be impaired.
Tissues from the liver to the brain had altered epigenetic patterns in mice with high levels of choline-eating microbes.
So now you know, epigenetic modifications change how genes are expressed. These modifications are also what makes our liver a liver and our heart a heart.
Estimates suggest that only about 10% of the U.S. population, including pregnant women, meets the recommended dietary intake of choline.
The nutritional demand for the nutrient increases during pregnancy to support the epigenetic regulation and cellular health in the developing fetus. And studies have linked choline deficiency during pregnancy in humans with altered behavior in children.
This is very important. Choline is found in high amounts in soybeans, eggs, meat, fish, cauliflower, milk, and other foods.
There are already human studies that show that choline deficiency is a problem that truly matters to human health. And what this study really provides is one possible mechanism by which this may be worsened.
Although Ray's team suspects that epigenetic regulation partially explains the negative effects of choline eating microbiomes, the byproduct of bacterial choline metabolism, known as TMAO, is also linked to negative outcomes. The toxic effects of TMAO accumulation also complicate potential dietary remedies. More choline in the diet might lead to more TMAO, rather than fixing nutritional shortages.
Well, we've come to the end of another Hey Doc show. Carmen and I hope that you've enjoyed the past half hour and have found it interesting, educational, and maybe just a little bit entertaining.
So, from all of us here at Southside Medical Center, have a happy and healthy weekend. Goodbye.